major parties after the next election. For the first time, he told them, they would have the chance to participate in a national government. He sent the delegates home, warning them to prepare for an election within the coming 12 months, by which time they would be able to welcome SDP members of parliament who would already be playing a major role in the running of the nation. Andrew's supporters left the West Country keyed up for battle. The Labour Party conference followed a week later at Brighton, and Raymond delivered a keynote speech on the state of the nation's finances. He pressed the unions to continue supporting their government by keeping the twin evils of inflation and unemployment at acceptable levels. Let us not pass on 3 years of achievement to be squandered by a Conservative government, he told the cheering delegates. Brothers, I look forward to presenting 5 more Labour budgets that will make it impossible for the Tories to imagine a future victory at the polls. Raymond received one of the rare standing ovations to be given any cabinet minister at a Labour Party conference. The delegates had never doubted his ability, but over the years they had grown to respect his sincerity as well as his judgment. 7 more days passed before Simon addressed the Tory faithful at the Conservative Party conference in Blackpool. By tradition, the leader always receives a 4 to 6 minute standing ovation after he completes his speech on the final day.
He'd still get 4 minutes, said Pimkin to a colleague, if he read them Das Kapital.
Simon had spent 6 weeks preparing for the occasion, since, like Andrew, he was convinced this would be the last conference before the election. He was pleasantly surprised to find Charles Seymour coming forward with new ideas on tax reform, which he hoped might be considered for inclusion in the leader's speech to the conference. Charles had recently been making useful contributions in the House during finance debates, and Simon hoped that it would not be long before he would be willing to return to the front bench. His main preoccupation in the House had been as a member of the chairman's panel, from which committee chairmen were recruited for each bill. Charles had mellowed considerably during his time on the back benches, and many of his friends feared he had lost his ambition for high office and might not even stand at the next election. Simon hoped this wasn't the case, as he desperately needed someone of Charles's ability to counter Raymond Gould at the Treasury. Simon included Charles's suggestion in the final draft of his speech and dropped him a handwritten note of thanks. On that Friday morning in Blackpool, in front of 2,000 delegates and millions more watching on television, Simon presented a complete and detailed plan of what he hoped to achieve when the Conservatives were returned to government.
Power is what we want, and power is what we seek, he told a mesmerized audience. For without power, we cannot serve.
After the peroration, the delegates duly rose for a genuine 6-minute ovation. When the noise had died down, Pimkin was heard to remark,
I think I made the right decision.
The conference season over, members made their way back from the three seasides to Westminster. Sadness overcame the House in their first week back when the aging Mr. Speaker Wetherill suffered a minor heart attack and retired to the Lords. The government's overall majority was only 2 at the time, and the Labour Party chief whip feared that if they supplied the new Speaker from their own ranks, and the Conservatives were to retain the old Speaker's safe seat, the government majority would cease to exist. Simon reluctantly agreed that the Speaker should come from his own benches, and asked his chief whip to suggest a suitable candidate. When Charles Seymour asked to be granted a private interview with the leader, Simon agreed immediately. Charles arrived at the opposition leader's office the following morning. It was the first time they had talked alone since the leadership battle. A head of white hair had grown from the roots of Charles's once Odyssean locks, and the deeper lines in Charles's face gave him a more gentle look. Simon couldn't help noticing a slight stoop had replaced his ramrod bearing. Looking at them now, no one would have suggested they were contemporaries. Charles's request came as a shock to Simon, for he had never once considered his great rival as a candidate for that particular job. "But I want you to return to the front bench and be my chancellor," said Simon. "You must know I would be delighted to have you back on the team."
"That's considerate of you," said Charles. "But I would prefer the more restful life of being an arbitrator rather than an antagonist. I've lost that desire always to be on the attack. For over 20 years you've had the advantage of Elizabeth and 2 sons to keep your feet on the ground. It's only quite recently that Harry has done the same for me."
All men are thought to have one great moment in their careers in the House, and for Alec Pimkin, it was to be that day. The election of a Speaker in the Commons is a quaint affair. By ancient tradition, no one must appear to want the honour, and it's rare for more than one person to be proposed for the post. During Henry VI's reign, 3 speakers were beheaded within a year, although in modern times it has been more the heavy burden of duties that has often led to an early grave. This tradition of reluctance has carried on through the ages, and for that reason a future speaker frequently doesn't know who has sponsored him. Dressed in a smart blue suit, sporting a red carnation and his favourite pink-spotted bow tie, Alec Pimkin rose from his seat on the back benches to move that the Right Honourable Charles Seymour does take the chair of this House as Speaker. His speech was serious yet witty, informed but personal. Pimkin held the House in his grasp for 9 minutes and never once let it go. "He's done his old friend proud," one member muttered to another across the gangway when Pimkin sat down. And indeed, the look on Charles's face left no doubt that he felt the same way, whatever had taken place in the past. After Charles had been seconded, the tradition of dragging the Speaker-elect to the chair was observed. This normally humorous affair, usually greeted with hoots of laughter and cheering, became even more of a farce with the sight of the small, portly Pimkin and his Labour seconder dragging the 6'4" former Guards officer from the 3rd row of the back benches all the way to the chair. Charles surveyed the Commons from his new vantage point. He began by expressing his grateful thanks for the high honour the House had bestowed on him. From the moment he rose and stood his full height, every member knew they had selected the right man to guide them through the parliamentary calendar. The sharpness of his tongue may have gone, but there remained a firm delivery and natural authority that left none of his colleagues in any doubt that Mr. Speaker Seymour intended to keep order for many years to come. The Conservatives held the Croydon North East seat comfortably at the by-election and captured a marginal 6 weeks later. The press pointed out that it only needed the Tories and the SDP Liberal Alliance to join together for the government and opposition to be in equal numbers, leaving the 17 Irish members to decide the fate of the Parliament. Raymond was determined that the government should hold on for another few weeks so that he could deliver his 3rd budget, which he was convinced would act as a launching pad on which to fight the election. Andrew had realised that Raymond's next budget might help Labour's chances at the polls, and he sought an official meeting with the Leader of the Opposition to discuss the possibility of a no-confidence motion. Simon agreed with Andrew's suggestion and thought that they should time the debate for the end of March. If they won, that would ensure an election before the budget. Raymond had accepted an invitation to address a large Labour rally in Cardiff the weekend before the vote of no-confidence. He boarded the train at Paddington, settled into his compartment, and began to check over his speech. As the train pulled into Swindon, a railway official stepped on board, and having discovered where the Chancellor of the Exchequer was seated, asked if he could speak to him privately for a few minutes. Raymond listened carefully to what the man had to say, replaced the speech in his briefcase, got off the train, crossed the platform, and returned by the first available train to London. On the journey back, he tried to work out all the consequences of the news he'd just been told. As soon as he arrived at Paddington, he made his way through the waiting photographers and journalists, answering no questions. A car took him straight to Westminster Hospital. Raymond was shown into a private room to find the Prime Minister sitting upright in bed.
"Now, don't panic," he said before Raymond could speak. "I'm in fine shape, considering I'm over 60, and with all the pressure we've been under this last year."
"What's wrong with you?" asked Raymond, taking a chair next to the bed.
"Recurrence of the old trouble. Only this time they say it will take major surgery. I'll be out of this place in a month, 6 weeks at the most, and then I'll live as long as Harold Macmillan, they tell me. Now, it's in more important matters. I want you to take over for me again, which will mean you'll have to speak in my place during the no-confidence debate on Wednesday. If we lose the vote, I shall resign as leader."
Raymond tried to protest, as he'd already worked out the implications the moment he had heard his leader was ill again. The Prime Minister held up his hand and continued talking.
"No party can fight an election with its leader laid up in bed for 6 weeks, however well he might be when they release him. If there is to be an election, the voters have the right to know who is going to lead the party in Parliament. And of course, in such an emergency, understanding Order No. 5, Paragraph 4 of the Labour Party Constitution," continued the Prime Minister, "the National Executive would meet and automatically select you to take over as party leader."
Raymond raised his head. "Yes, the importance of that particular standing order has already been pointed out to me." The Prime Minister smiled.
"Joyce, no doubt."
"Her name was Kate, actually." The Prime Minister looked puzzled and then continued.
"I think you must get used to the idea, Raymond, that you may well be running for Prime Minister in 3 weeks' time. Because if we lose the no-confidence vote on Wednesday, I'm given no choice but to advise the Queen to call an immediate general election."
Raymond remained silent.
"I can assure you," continued the Prime Minister, "the National Executive will not want an internal bloodbath 3 weeks before a general election. Nothing could be more certain to guarantee a Tory victory. If, however, we do win the no-confidence vote, then it's a different matter altogether, because I'll be back and running the ship long before the Easter recess is over. That'll give us enough time to call the election after you've delivered your third budget. So make sure you win on Wednesday."
"I'm unable to express how much we'll all miss your leadership," said Raymond without guile.
"As every member of the House except the Irish will know which lobby they'll be voting in long before the debate begins, my leadership may turn out to be less important than any single vote. And don't forget, it'll be the first occasion on which they've allowed television on the floor of the Commons, so make sure Joyce picks up one of those smart shirts you sometimes wear."
Raymond spent the final few days before the no-confidence vote preparing his speech. He cancelled all the engagements in his diary, except for the Speaker's dinner to celebrate the Queen's 65th birthday, at which he would be standing in for the Prime Minister. The government and opposition whips spent Monday and Tuesday checking that every member would be present in the House by 10 o'clock on Wednesday night. The political journalists pointed out that if the vote were a tie, Mr. Speaker Seymour had already made it clear that he would abide by the ancient tradition of giving his casting vote to the government of the day. Charles was armed with precedents from Speaker Addington in the 18th century to Speaker Denison in the 19th. Charles pointed out that, in line with the principle, he must vote in such a manner as not to make the decision of the chair final. Simon was to open the debate for the opposition, while Andrew was being allowed to wind up, the only concession Simon had granted the SDP Liberal Alliance for ensuring their support in the lobbies. Neil Kinnock was to open for the government, with Raymond winding up. When Raymond read his speech out to Joyce on the Tuesday night, the entire rehearsal took only 24 minutes,
But he explained to her that with the noise and interruptions that would occur in the chamber, he would be on his feet the full 30 minutes. In fact, he might have to cut short some lines on the night.
This ends side one of cassette 11. Please turn the cassette over and start side two at the same point.
The following day, members began arriving hours before the debate was due to begin. The Strangers' Gallery had been booked days in advance, with many senior ambassadors and even some privy councillors unable to be guaranteed a seat. The press gallery was filled, and editors were sitting at the feet of their political journalists' desks. The Commons itself was like a stand at a cup final, where twice as many tickets had been sold as there were seats. The only difference from a budget day was that the House was taken up with lighting equipment that had been tested a dozen times that morning. Between 2:30 and 3:30, Mr. Speaker Seymour had been unable to stop members chattering during questions to Mr. Meacher, the Secretary of State for Education. But at 3:30, he duly shouted for order and did not have to wait long for silence before calling the Leader of the Opposition. Simon rose from his place on the front bench to be greeted with cheers from his own side. He was momentarily surprised by the brightness of the arc lights, which he'd been assured he would hardly notice. But soon he was into his stride. Without a note in front of him, he addressed the House for 50 minutes, tearing into the government one moment, then switching to the policies he would implement the next. He ended his peroration by describing the Labour Party as the party of wasted opportunity, then added, jabbing his finger at Raymond, "But you will be replaced by a party of ideas and ideals." He sat down to the cheers of his backbenchers, who thought they had already won the vote, if not the next election as well. The noise continued for some time before Charles could bring the House back to order and call the next speaker. Neil Kinnock had always revelled in his Welsh ancestry and had often been compared by older members to a Nairn Bevan. The bête noire of the Tories set into the opposition leader with a vengeance, expounding his beliefs and rousing his own side to cheers when he said that the Tories would be routed and would regret this no-confidence trick for a decade. "The Right Honourable Gentleman," he said, pointing at Simon, "has the nerve to call us the party of wasted opportunities. For the past 2 years it is he who has led the party of opportunists and who will be leader of the opposition until it is time for him to be replaced." When Kinnock sat down, the television producers couldn't be blamed for thinking that they were covering a Lions versus Christian slaughter. Again, it took the speaker several minutes to bring the House back to order. The backbenchers also rose to the occasion, with speeches from past ministers quoting precedent and from young Turks demanding change, which helped confirm old and establish new reputations. The House remained packed that night, right up until 9 o'clock, when the Speaker called Andrew Fraser to wind up for the opposition. Andrew delivered a plague on both your houses speech, and shouted above the protests from the two main parties, "When the time comes, you'll both need to call on an honest broker." At 9:30, when he resumed his seat, Andrew was cheered as loudly as 42 members in unison could manage. When it came to Raymond's turn to wind up, members wondered how he would make himself heard above the noise that greeted him. He rose to the dispatch box, and looking grave, with head bowed, almost whispered his first words. "Mr. Speaker, I know the whole House would wish me to open my speech by saying how sad we all are that the Prime Minister is unable to be present tonight. I'm sure all honourable members will want to join me in sending him, his wife and family, our best wishes as he prepares for his operation." Suddenly the House was silent, and having caught its mood, Raymond raised his head and delivered, for the 11th time, the speech he had prepared so assiduously. When he had seen Simon give his apparently impromptu speech, Raymond had torn up his notes. He spelled out the achievements of the government during the past 2.5 years and assured the House that he was only halfway through his time as Chancellor. "I've not been able to achieve equality in 3 years, but of one thing I am certain. I look forward to delivering my next budget, whatever the outcome of the vote tonight. We shall not see the opportunist government of the Conservatives or the Alliance's so-called honest broker. Indeed, looking at the Alliance, I can say there is no one less honest and no one more broke. We, Mr. Speaker, will see the return of a Labour government for another full Parliament." Raymond sat down as the clock reached 10. He found, like the speakers before him, that he was drenched in sweat from the heat sent out by the powerful arc lights. The speaker rose, and his first words were lost as he put the question. "This House has no confidence in Her Majesty's government. As many as are of that opinion say aye. To the contrary, no. I think the ayes have it." "No," hollered back the voices from the government benches. "Clear the lobbies," called the speaker above the cheers for Raymond Gould. Members departed to the lobbies to cast their votes. The Irish members surprised no one by dividing among themselves. 14 minutes later, the tellers returned to a noisy chamber to give the result of the division to the clerk at the table, who then entered the figures on a division paper. The four tellers lined up and advanced towards the table from the bar of the House. They came to a halt and bowed for a third time. One of the opposition whips read out, "Eyes to the right, 323, nose to the left, 322, and passed the piece of paper to the Speaker, who tried to repeat it above the bedlam. Few members heard him say, "The ayes have it, the ayes have it." Raymond sat on the front bench and watched the delighted Tories bobbing up and down like children on a carousel. He reflected that if the Prime Minister had been present to register his vote, the government would have saved the day. Her Majesty the Queen visited her Prime Minister in hospital 24 hours after his successful operation. He advised the monarch to dissolve Parliament immediately and asked that the general election be set for the 9th of May. He explained to the Queen that he intended to resign as leader of his party that morning and would relinquish the office of Prime Minister as soon as the outcome of the election was clear. Before she left the Westminster Hospital, the Queen spent some time discussing a private constitutional issue with the Prime Minister. He suggested that when the Labour Party had confirmed their new leader, he must be the man to offer her advice on such a personal matter. The National Executive of the Labour Party met behind the closed doors of Transport House in Smith Square at 10 o'clock the following morning to select their new leader. 3 hours and 20 minutes later, the committee issued a one-line press statement. "Mr. Raymond Gould has been invited to lead the party at the forthcoming general election." Although no one was in any doubt about the fierce arguments that must have taken place during the meeting, the press were met by a unified voice once the committee finally broke up. As Lord Broadstairs, the former Prime Minister, wrote in the centre page of the Sunday Express that weekend, "The Labour Party, in selecting their leader, resembled nothing less than the old-fashioned magic circle of Lord Rosebery in their determination to prove unity." The only leak he had managed to gather from the meeting was that Raymond Gould's acceptance speech had impressed everyone present. But Lord Broadstairs went on to point out that if the Labour Party should lose the general election, Raymond Gould could be the shortest-serving leader in the Labour Party's history, as, understanding Order 5, Paragraph 4 of the Constitution, his appointment had to be confirmed by the delegates at the next party conference in October. It had been 2 hours before Raymond was able to leave Transport House and escape the press. When he eventually got away, he went straight to Westminster Hospital to visit the Prime Minister. The operation had visibly aged him.
He was in good spirits, but admitted that he was glad not to be facing a grueling election campaign. After he had congratulated Raymond on his new post, he went on to say, "You're dining with the Queen tonight." "Yes, to celebrate her 65th birthday," said Raymond. "There's more to it than that," said the Prime Minister gravely, and he then revealed the private conversation that he had had with the monarch the previous day. "And will her decision depend on the four people in that room?"
"I suspect it will."
"And what's your attitude?"
"That's no longer relevant, because I shall resign as Prime Minister the day after the election. So it's more important that the new Prime Minister considers what is best for the country."
For the first time, Raymond felt like the leader of the party. Chapter 34 Elizabeth straightened Simon's white tie and took a pace back to look at him.
"Well, at least you look like a Prime Minister," she said, smiling.
Her husband checked his watch. Still a few minutes to spare before he needed to be at the Speaker's private apartments. Not that he was willing to risk being late for this particular birthday celebration. Elizabeth helped him on with his overcoat, and after a search, realized he'd lost another pair of gloves.
"I do hope you can take care of the nation's belongings a little better than you do your own," she sighed.
"I'm sure I'll find it hard to lose the whole country," said Simon.
"Do remember that Raymond Gould will be trying to help you," said Elizabeth.
"Yes, that's true. I only wish I was fighting Kinnock."
"Why?"
she asked. "Because Gould was born into the wrong party," said Simon as he kissed his wife and walked towards the front door. "And a lot of the electorate have already reached the same conclusion." The policeman on the gates of New Palace Yard saluted as Simon was driven into the courtyard and dropped at the members' entrance. He glanced at his watch again. 10 minutes to spare. He could never resist checking how many people were in the chamber or what the latest news was on the ticker tape machine. He put his head round the door of the smoking room. A few members were scattered around, mainly from safe seats they felt did not need nursing. Pimkin, surrounded by his usual cronies, hailed him. His face lit up when he saw Simon formally dressed.
"I say, waiter, mine's a double gin and tonic."
His companions duly laughed. Simon responded by asking the barman to give Mr. Pimkin a large gin and tonic and to charge it to his account. He spent a few minutes moving from group to group, chatting to members about how the election might go in their constituencies. Pimkin assured Simon that the Tories would return in triumph. "I wish everyone was as confident as you are," Simon told him before leaving for the Speaker's private apartments, as Pimkin ordered another gin. He strolled along the library corridor, lined from floor to ceiling with venerable old journals of the House, until he reached the Speaker's office, which is the route members take to the Speaker's private rooms. When Simon reached the grand stairway, dominated by Speaker Addington's portrait, he was met by the Speaker's train-bearer, clad in white tie and black tails.
"Good evening, Mr. Carslake," he said, and led Simon down the corridor into the antechamber, where a relaxed Charles Seymour stood ready to receive his guests.
Charles shook Simon's hand warmly. Simon thought how well his colleague looked compared with their meeting of a few months before. Andrew Fraser had already arrived, and soon the three men were deep into a discussion about the course the election would take, when another guest walked in. "The Right Honourable Raymond Gould," announced the train-bearer. Charles went over to greet his guest.
"Many congratulations on your election as leader," were his first words. "You've had one hell of a week. You must be exhausted."
"Exhilarated, to be honest," replied Raymond. He moved towards Simon, who in turn offered his congratulations. The two men shook hands, and for a moment resembled medieval knights who had lowered their visors before the final joust. The unnatural silence that followed was broken by Andrew.
Well, I hope it's going to be a clean fight, he said. Both men laughed. The train bearer came to the speaker's side to inform him that Her Majesty had left Buckingham Palace a few moments earlier. Charles excused himself while the three leaders continued their conversation. "Has either of you been told the real reason why we're bidden here this evening?" asked Raymond. "Isn't the Queen's 65th birthday enough?" said Simon. "No, that's just an excuse for us to meet without suspicion. I think it might be helpful for you both to know that Her Majesty has a highly sensitive question to put to us." Simon and Andrew listened as Raymond revealed the substance of his discussion with the Prime Minister. Charles waited in the entrance of the courtyard of the Speaker's house to welcome the Queen. It was only a few minutes before he spotted two police outriders entering the gates of New Palace Yard, followed by the familiar maroon Rolls-Royce, which displayed no number plate. A tiny white light on the centre of the roof blinked in the evening dusk. As soon as the car had come to a halt, a footman leapt down and opened the back door. The Queen stepped out, to be greeted by the commoner history had judged to be the monarch's man. She was dressed in a simple cocktail dress. The only jewellery she wore was a string of pearls and a small diamond brooch. Charles bowed before shaking hands and taking his guest up the carpeted staircase to his private apartments. Her three party leaders stood in line, waiting to greet her. She shook hands first with the new leader of the Labour Party and congratulated him on his election that afternoon, before inquiring how the Prime Minister was faring. Then she shook hands with her leader of the opposition and asked how his wife was coping at Pucklebridge General Hospital after the new national health cutbacks. Simon was always amazed by how much the Queen could recall from her past conversations, few of which could ever last more than a few moments. She then moved on to Andrew, whom she teased about his father's recent speech in Edinburgh on the Social Democrats' greatest weakness being their lack of leadership. "He's very old, ma'am," insisted Andrew.
"Not as old as Gladstone when he formed his last administration," she replied.
She removed the gin and tonic offered to her on a silver tray and looked around the magnificent room.
"My husband and I are great admirers of the Gothic revival in architecture. Though being infrequent visitors to Westminster, we are, however, usually forced to view the better examples from the outside of a railway station or from the inside of cathedrals."
The four men smiled, and a few minutes later Charles suggested they adjourn to the state dining room, where five places were set out around an oval table covered with silver which glittered in the candlelight. The four men waited until the Queen was seated at the head of the table. Charles had placed Raymond on the Queen's right and Simon on her left, while he and Andrew filled the other two places. When the champagne was served, Charles and his colleagues rose and toasted the Queen's health. She reminded them that her birthday was not for another 2 weeks, and remarked that she had 24 official birthday engagements during the month, which didn't include the family's private celebrations.
"I would happily weaken, but the Queen Mother attended more functions for her 90th birthday last year than I've planned for my 65th. I can't imagine where she gets the energy."
"Perhaps she would like to take my place in the election campaign," said Raymond.
"Don't suggest it," the Queen replied. "She would leap at the opportunity without a second thought."
The chef had prepared a simple dinner of smoked salmon, followed by lamb in red wine and aspic. His only flamboyant gesture was a birthday cake in the shape of a crown resting on a portcullis of sponge. No candles were evident. After the meal had been cleared away and the cognac served, the servants left them alone. The four men remained in a light mood until the Queen, without warning, put to them a delicate question that surprised only Charles. She waited for an answer. No one spoke.
"Perhaps I should ask you first," said the Queen, turning to Raymond, "as you are standing in for the Prime Minister."
Raymond didn't hesitate.
"I'm in favour, ma'am," he said quietly. She next turned to Simon.
I would also support such a decision, Your Majesty, he replied.
Thank you, said the Queen, and turned to Andrew.
At heart, I'm a traditionalist, Your Majesty, but I confess to having given the subject a great deal of thought over the last few years, and I've come round to supporting what I think is described as the modern approach.
Thank you, she repeated, her eyes finally resting on Charles Seymour.
Against, ma'am, he said without hesitation. But then I have never been a modern man.
That is no bad thing in Mr. Speaker, she said, and paused before adding, Some years ago, I asked a former Lord Chancellor to draw up the necessary papers. He assured me then that if none of my parliamentary leaders was against the principle, the legislation could be carried through while both houses were still in session.
That is correct, ma'am, said Charles. It would require 2 or 3 days at most if all the preparations have already been completed. It's only a matter of proclamation to both houses of Parliament. Your decision requires no vote.
Excellent, Mr. Speaker. Then the matter is settled.
Book 6, 1991. Prime Minister. Chapter 35. Her Majesty's proclamation passed through the Lords and Commons without a division. Once the initial shock had been absorbed by the nation, the election campaign took over. The first polls gave the Tories a 2-point lead. The press attributed this to the public some familiarity with the new Labour leader, but by the end of the first week, the Tories had slipped a point, while the press had decided that Raymond Gould had begun his stewardship well. A week is a long time in politics, he quoted, and there are still 2 to go, Joyce reminded him. The pundits put forward the theory that Raymond had increased his popularity during the first week because of the extra coverage he'd received as the new leader of the Labour Party. He warned the press department at Transport House that it might well be the shortest honeymoon on record, and they certainly couldn't expect him to be treated like a bridegroom for the entire 3 weeks. The first signs of a broken marriage came when the Department of Employment announced that inflation had taken an upturn for the first time in 9 months.
And who has been Chancellor for the last 3 years? Demanded Simon in that night's speech in Manchester.
Raymond tried to dismiss the figures as a one-off monthly hiccup, but the next day Simon was insistent that there was more bad news just around the corner. When the Department of Trade announced the worst deficit in the balance of payments for 14 months, Simon took on the mantle of a prophet, and the Tories edged back into a healthy lead, but with the Social Democrats stealing a point from both of them. Honeymoon, broken marriage, and divorce, all in a period of 14 days, said Raymond Riley. What can happen in the last 7?
Reconciliation, perhaps, suggested Joyce.
During the campaign, all 3 leaders managed to visit most of the 100 marginal seats in which the outcome of any general election is decided. None of them could afford to spend too much time worrying about those 550 of the 650 seats that could not change hands without a swing of at least 8%. Andrew was willing to make one exception to the 8% rule in the case of Alec Pimpkin's seat in Littlehampton, which he had considered vulnerable for some time. The Social Democrats had selected an able young candidate who had nursed the constituency assiduously over the past 3 years and couldn't wait to take on Pimpkin. Alec Pimpkin eventually made an appearance in Littlehampton, only after the local chairman had tracked him down to his London flat to say they were becoming desperate. The Alliance yellow lines were almost as abundant on the canvass returns as the Conservative blue ones, he warned.
"Don't you realise that I've had grave responsibilities in the Commons?" Pimpkin declared. "No one could have anticipated that members would have been called back for a special declaration by the monarch."
"Everyone knows about that," said the chairman,
but the bill commanded by the Queen went through all its three readings last week without a division.
Pimkin inwardly cursed the day they allowed television into the House.
"Don't fuss," he soothed. "Come the hour, cometh the man, and the voters will remember that I've had a long and distinguished parliamentary career. Damn it, old thing, have you forgotten that I was a candidate for the leadership of the Tory party?"
"No. And how many votes did you receive on that occasion?" the chairman wanted to say. But he took a deep breath and repeated his urgent request that the member visit the constituency as soon as possible. Pimkin arrived 7 days before the election, and as in past campaigns, settled himself in the private bar of the Swan Arms, the only decent pub in the constituency, he assured those people who took the trouble to come over and seek his opinion. "But the Alliance candidate has visited every pub in the division," wailed the chairman.
"More fool he. We can say that he's looking for any excuse for a pub crawl," said Pimkin, roaring with laughter.
From time to time, Pimkin did stroll over to committee headquarters to find a few loyal workers licking envelopes and folding election messages. On the one occasion on which he ventured into the High Street, he was appalled to discover Andrew Fraser standing on an upturned box, extolling the virtues of the Alliance candidate to a large crowd. Pimkin wandered over to listen to what Andrew had to say, and was not pleased to find that hardly anyone in the crowd recognised him.
"Humbug!" said Pimkin at the top of his voice.
Andrew waved back.
"Little Hampton needs a member who lives in the constituency," declared Andrew genially, and went on with his speech. Pimkin turned to retreat to the warmth of the fireside at the Swan Arms. After all, as the landlord had assured him, put up a donkey with a blue ribbon as the Conservative candidate in Littlehampton, and they would elect it.
Pimkin had not been overwhelmed by the analogy. With 6 days to go, Andrew held a meeting with the Liberals to discuss tactics. The Alliance began to record over 22% in some polls, while the Labour and Conservative vote remained neck and neck with 38% each. Andrew's continual claim that he would hold the balance of power in the next Parliament was analysed seriously by The Observer and Sunday Times over the last weekend of the campaign, and few political pundits were now disagreeing with him. Both the BBC and ITV were already trying to book him for the first interview after the election. Andrew made no commitment. He travelled up from Liverpool to Glasgow on the Monday before the election, and then trekked across Scotland, pursued by a pack of journalists, until he reached Edinburgh on the Wednesday night. The same evening, Simon returned to Pucklebridge to deliver his last speech of the campaign in the local village hall. 418 sat inside to hear his speech. 4,000 more stood outside in the cold, listening to his words being relayed by loudspeaker. Simon's final message to his supporters all over the country was, "Be sure you go to the polls tomorrow. Every vote will be vital." The statement turned out to be the most accurate any of the three leaders had made during the entire 3-week campaign. Raymond had returned to Leeds on the evening and was met on the platform of Leeds City Station by the Lord Mayor and over half the corporation. He was driven to the town hall to deliver his last appeal to the electorate before an audience of 2,000 people. Somehow, he raised himself to give one more speech, and the cheers that greeted his arrival at the town hall made him forget he hadn't had more than 4 hours' sleep a night during the last month. Introducing the Labour leader, the mayor said, "Ray has come home." Raymond stood up and delivered his speech as vigorously as if it were the opening day of the campaign. When he sat down 40 minutes later, he felt his legs give way. As soon as the hall was cleared, Joyce and Fred Paget took the exhausted candidate home. He fell asleep in the car on the way back, so the two of them helped him upstairs, undressed him, and let him sleep on until 6 the next morning. All three leaders were up by 6, preparing for interviews on both breakfast television channels, followed by the obligatory photo of each arriving at a polling station, accompanied by his wife, to cast their votes. Andrew enjoyed being back in Edinburgh, where for a few hours he was allowed to recall the days of recounts and catch up with the many old who had made it possible for him to remain in Parliament.
Once again, he ended up on the steps of the final polling station as the City Hall clock struck 10. No, Mrs. Bloxham was there to remind him that she only voted for winners. She had died the previous year. Andrew, Louise, and Clarissa walked back to the local SDP headquarters arm in arm to join their supporters and watch the results as they came in on television. Raymond and Joyce remained in Leeds overnight, while Simon and Elizabeth returned to London to follow the outcome at Central Office in Smith Square. Raymond couldn't remember when he had last watched television for 3 hours without a break. The first result came from Guildford at 11:21 and showed a 2% swing to the Conservatives. "Not enough," said Simon from the party chairman's room at Central Office. "It may not be enough," said Raymond, when the next two seats delivered their verdict and the swing remained the same. The first shock came a few minutes after midnight when the Social Democrats captured the Labour seat of Rugby, and less than 30 minutes later followed it by taking Billericay from the Conservatives. When the first 100 seats had been declared, the pundits were certain of only one thing. They were uncertain what the final outcome would be. Opinions, expert and amateur, were still fluid at 1 o'clock that morning, by which time 200 results were in, and remained so at 2 o'clock when over 300 constituencies had selected their member. Raymond went to bed with a lead of 236 to 191 over Simon, knowing it would be offset by the county shires the next day. Andrew had gained 4 seats and lost 1 to give the Alliance 32 seats overnight. The next morning, pundits were back on radio and television by 6 o'clock, all agreeing with the Daily Mail's headline, "Stalemate." Raymond and Joyce returned to London on the early morning train, while the rural seats were proving their traditional loyalty to the Conservatives. Simon travelled down to Pucklebridge to acknowledge a record majority. He wished he could have sacrificed a couple of thousand for the marginals that weren't going his way. By 12:33, when Raymond had reached number 11 Downing Street, the Labour lead had fallen to 287 to 276, while the Alliance had captured 44 seats. At 12 o'clock that Friday morning, the cameras from all 4 channels swung over to Edinburgh, where the sheriff was declaring that Andrew Fraser had been returned to the House with a majority of over 7,000. The cameras moved on to show the victor, hands high above his head. The number on the SDP chart flicked up to 45. By 1 o'clock, the Social Democrats notched up their 46th victory by a mere 72 votes, a result which saddened Simon. "The House won't be quite the same without Alec Pimpkin," he told Elizabeth. At 2:23 that Friday afternoon, both the major parties had 292 seats, with only 2 safe Tory-held seats still to be declared. Simon retained the first, but Andrew picked up the last after 3 recounts. At 4 o'clock, Lord Day of Langham announced from the BBC studios the final result of the 1991 election. Conservative, 293. Labour, 292. SDP Liberal, 47. Irish, 17. Speaker, 1. Lord Day went on to point out that the popular vote made the outcome even more finely balanced, with Labour taking 12,246,341, 35.2%. Conservatives, 12,211,907, 35.1%, and the Alliance, 8,649,881, 25.4%. He told viewers that he had never experienced a result like it in his 36 years as a political journalist. He apologised for his failure to get an interview with Andrew Fraser, who now held the key as to who would form the next government. Andrew phoned Simon first, then Raymond. He listened intently to both men and what they were willing to offer, before telling them that he intended to hold a meeting of his members in London on Sunday and relay their comments. He would report back with their decision in the hope that a government could be formed by Monday. Andrew and Louise flew down from Edinburgh on the Saturday morning, together with a plane load of journalists. but by the time Andrew disappeared outside Terminal 1 into a waiting car, the press had nothing new to report. Sir Duncan had already told the Scotsman that his son would naturally back the Conservatives, while the former Prime Minister announced from his bedside that Andrew had always been a good socialist at heart and would have nothing to do with the capitalist cause. On the Saturday, Andrew held several informal meetings in Pelham Crescent with senior members of the Alliance to ascertain the views of his colleagues, old and new. By the time he went to bed, he still had no clear mandate, and when a newscaster said no one was sure how the SDP Liberal Alliance would vote the following day in their private meeting, Andrew added out loud, "Me included." Even so, he had decided, after much deliberation on the qualities of the two men and what they stood for, and that helped him make up his mind which party he thought should form the next government. At the Commons the next morning, he and every other SDP and Liberal member had to run the gauntlet of journalists and photographers on the way to a closely guarded committee room on the third floor. The whip had deliberately selected one of the less accessible rooms and had asked the sergeant-at-arms to be certain that recording machines were disconnected. Andrew opened the meeting by congratulating his colleagues on their election to the House of Commons. "But it is important to remember," he continued, "that the nation will never forgive us if we are irresponsible with our new power. We cannot afford to say we will support one party, then change our minds after only a few weeks, causing another general election. We must be seen to be responsible, or you can be sure that when the next election comes, every one of us will forfeit our seats." He went on to describe in detail how both the major party leaders had accepted the general direction in which he felt the new government should be moving. He reported that they had both accepted that two members of the Alliance should have seats in the cabinet. Both had also agreed to back a motion in the Commons for a referendum on proportional representation. For 3 hours, the SDP Liberal members gave their views. But by the end of that time, Andrew was still unable to steer them to a consensus and had to call for a ballot. Andrew did not vote himself and left the SDP Liberal and Chief Whips to count the votes and announce the result. 23 votes each was the decision of his members. The Chief Whip informed the parliamentary party that they would have to allow their elected leader to make the final decision. He, after all, was the biggest single reason they had been returned to the House in such relatively large numbers. After 27 years in the Commons, he must have the clearest view of which man and which party was the most capable of governing the country. When the Chief Whip sat down, the word "agreed" came over clearly from the lips of the members sitting round the long table, and the meeting broke up. Andrew returned to Pelham Crescent and told Louise which man he had decided to support. She seemed surprised. Later that night, he left for a quiet dinner at the Athenaeum with the Sovereign's private secretary. The equerry returned to Buckingham Palace a little after 11 o'clock and briefed the monarch on the salient points of their discussion. "Mr. Fraser," the private secretary said, "is not in favour of another quick election, and has made it quite clear which party the Social Democrats are willing to support in the Commons." The monarch nodded thoughtfully, thanked his private secretary, and retired to bed. Chapter 36. King Charles III made the final decision. As Big Ben struck 10 o'clock on that Saturday morning, a private secretary to the royal household phoned the Right Honourable Simon Carslake and asked if he would be kind enough to attend His Majesty at the palace. Simon stepped out of the Conservative Party headquarters on the corner of Smith Square and into the clear morning sunlight to be greeted by crowds of well-wishers, television cameras and journalists. He only smiled and waved, as this was not the occasion to make a statement. He slipped quickly through the police cordon and into the back of his black Rover. Motorcycle outriders guided the chauffeur-driven car through the dense crowds, slowly past Transport House.
Simon wondered what would be going through Raymond Gould's mind at that moment, as he considered the decision Andrew Fraser must have made. The chauffeur drove on to Millbank, past the House of Commons, round Parliament Square, and left into Birdcage Walk, before reaching the Mall. Scotland Yard had been briefed as to which party leader had been called to see the King, and the car never stopped once on its journey to the palace. The chauffeur then swung into the Mall, and Buckingham Palace loomed in front of Simon's eyes. At every junction, a policeman held up the traffic and then saluted. Suddenly, it was all worthwhile. Simon went back over the years and then considered the future. His first thoughts were of Elizabeth and the children, how he wished they could be with him now. He recalled his selection at Coventry, the loss of his seat and the continual rejections before Pucklebridge, the financial crisis, the resignation letter that Archie Milburn had promised to return the day he became Prime Minister, the Irish Charter, broadsword, and his final battle with Charles Seymour. The rover reached the end of the Mall and circled the statue of Queen Victoria before arriving at the vast wrought-iron gates outside Buckingham Palace. A sentry in the scarlet uniform of the Grenadier Guards presented arms. The huge crowds that had been waiting round the gates from the early hours craned their necks in an effort to see who had been chosen to lead them. Simon smiled and waved. In response, some of them waved back and cheered more loudly, while others looked sulky and downcast. The rover continued on its way past the sentry and across the courtyard through the archway and into the quadrangle before coming to a halt on the gravel by a side entrance. Simon stepped out of the car to be met by the King's private secretary. The silent equerry led Simon up a semicircular staircase, past the Allan Rumsey portrait of George III, and down a long corridor before entering the audience chamber. He bowed and left Simon alone with his new sovereign. Simon could feel his pulse quicken as he took 3 paces forward, bowed, and waited for the King to speak. The 43-year-old monarch showed no sign of nervousness in carrying out his first official duty, despite its unusual delicacy.
"Mr. Karslake," he began, "I wanted to see you first, as I thought it would be courteous to explain to you in detail why I shall be inviting Miss Raymond Gould to be my first Prime Minister."
The End. You've been listening to First Among Equals by Geoffrey Archer, narrated by Simon Preble. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Recorded Books recommends Dance While You Can by Susan Lewis, a dual narration by Simon Preble and Barbara Rosenblatt, in which passion, politics, and class become entwined in a tension-laden drama of ill-fated love. You'll find a wide selection of titles, including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more in the Recorded Books catalogue. So to order another Recorded Book, or for a copy of our latest listing, call us toll-free nationwide at 1-800-638-1304. You can order by phone with Visa or MasterCard, or by writing to us, or by faxing us at 410-535-5499. Don't forget to ask about easy 30-day rentals by mail. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.